Good evening to all of you. It's good to see you. Glad to be with you. Have a fairly good crowd here tonight. And I'm just happy to be here. A little bit about myself, without going into a lot of detail, since most of you don't know me, I'm Bruce Hudson. I grew up in Bradenton, Florida. And so I'm an original Floridian, or as we say, cracker. Only some of us would know that since we were born here. And I haven't forgotten my roots. I have a lot of memories of that time. And then we moved up north for a long period of time. In between, we were in Kentucky for a year, and then we were in Lakeland for a year. So some of you are too young to remember that. That was around 1989. I worked with the Southwest congregation. We lived over on Cleveland Heights Boulevard. That's kind of a name you don't forget. And so it made it difficult on our two children at that time. They were small, having been born and raised in Maine. It was quite a difference, and so we decided to move back for a variety of reasons. And I saw Mary Henderson tonight. That was back in those days. Ronnie and Mary worshiped with us, but at that time I think you all were going down Fort Meade. I think Ronnie was preaching down there on Sunday mornings. But I've always been grateful to him. I found him to be extremely knowledgeable, an extremely wise man. And probably he's, out of all the folks that were there, he made an impression upon me at that time to get me to go there. So that's another story, a long story. But I was a young kid back then. I think I was 25. So there were some that weren't sure that they wanted to receive a 25-year-old, and the other half were younger people closer to my age who thought, yeah, we want Bruce. And it was Ronnie who stood up and said some things that I'll never forget. He pointed out in the meeting that Bruce at 25 could run for the House of Representatives. And at 30 years of age, he could run for the Senate. And at 35, he could run for the presidency of the United States. And I mean, in that room of all those men there at that time, myself included, I was just in a state of shock. I was like, wow, that was impressive. And there, nobody said a word. Then they asked me to step out, and when I came back in, they wanted me to come on the basis of 1 year. And so that's how that all worked out. So I've never forgotten the Hendersons. And I know Mary's family quite well. We worship with Miss Norma Cannon down in Fort Meade where I preach. And so that's a little bit of my background. Vicki couldn't make it tonight. She didn't make it this morning either in Fort Meade. She just wasn't feeling well. That's not what I want to talk to you about, but I thought I should give you a little background on who it is that's preaching the gospel for you tonight. And I want to talk to you about problems that come up in our lives that seem to be impossible for us to solve, or to think about how am I gonna fix this. And if you've never been in a situation, although I think I speak before some folks that have some age behind them, that you've been in situations that you didn't know what you were going to do. You didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know how to resolve it. And whether it's financial, or whether it's a personal problem, or a morality, or friendships, or relationships, parents and children, brothers and sisters. And it's at that time that you're the most vulnerable for the devil. And sometimes we give in to that. And we're not the first. That's the message of the Bible. We're not the first. Eve gave in to it, and she was God's first second child, Adam being the first. And so the problem of sin and the problem of death began then. And we're just a part of that long history of the human race, of looking at a problem that we don't know how to solve. And if we're blessed enough to have an older person in our life that we can rely on, that we can lean on, that's great. But I suggest to you that the one we really need to rely on is God, and that's the basis for this lesson. I want to talk to you about facing impossible situations. And throughout my life, I've faced impossible situations many times. So I know I'm standing in front of folks that have likewise shared in the same. And some of you are young people. And I submit to you, I've sat in your seat. And some of these other folks have sat in your seat too. But you look at them and they're older and gray-headed, a little extra weight on them, and you think, they've never faced the problems that I have to face. Yes, in every generation, sometimes the problems differ. They're different. But at heart, it's really the same kind of problem. And that is the problem of sin, the problem of temptation, and how do I get out of this? We're going to be looking at John chapter 6 tonight, if you want to turn there, but I've got the scriptures on the screen for you. So in talking about facing impossible situations, I want to look at some Old Testament scriptures first and then a couple of New Testament scriptures that deal generally with this problem. You remember that Abraham and Sarah were promised a son by God. His name was going to be Isaac. We all know that. And you would have expected that when God first came to Abraham and Sarah and told them that they were going to have a son, that 9 months later, the baby would be there. That didn't happen. You would expect maybe a year, 2 years at most. It's going to happen. And it's like 25 years before they have that son. In fact, it gets past the point of being able to have children. And that's, of course, where their faith comes in. And God comes back to them and says, you're going to have a son. Sarah will have a son at the appointed time. And Sarah laughed at that. And in Genesis 18, verse 14, God rhetorically says, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you. And according to the time of life, Sarah shall have a son. That's a confident statement. There's no question that that is going to happen. Sarah laughed, really, I think, like you or I would. It had been 25 years. She couldn't have children. And yet God returns and says, no, this is going to happen. During the time of Jeremiah, the prophet, we see that the Babylonians have surrounded the city of Jerusalem and its walls. And Jeremiah prays to the Lord, and he begins his prayer by saying, ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you. As he continues in the prayer, you see that he kind of starts saying to God, by the way, have you noticed we have some armies that are surrounding our city? He's praying to God to do something about that. And he lets him know, because of your great creation, I know there's nothing too hard for you to do. God actually responds to that prayer in the same chapter in verse 27. And God says, behold, I am the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? So he responds to Jeremiah by saying, not only did I create the heavens and the earth, I created you. I created all flesh. There's nothing too hard for me to do. When we can try to conceive or comprehend this great God creating everything out of what? Nothing. I'm here to tell you tonight, if you've never thought about it, there is nothing too hard for God to do. I don't care what it is. If He can create the universe, if He can create the bodies that you and I walk around in, with the brains that we have, the minds that we have, with the soul that we have, God can do anything. He can do anything that He chooses to do. The New Testament, really, and by the way, when God rhetorically says, is there anything too hard for me to do? You might say, well, that may be true for back then, but it's 2025, and I'm facing something as a young person that I've never faced before, and I don't know what to do. I don't know who to go to. You can go to God. God will listen to you. God will hear you. Sometimes people will say, if you knew my situation, if you had a dollar for every time you had that said, if you knew my situation, I know your situation. I've read this. And besides reading this, I've read this. I've been there. And a lot of people that are sitting in this auditorium have been there too. We know what you're up against. More than all of us knowing what you're up against, young people, realize this, God knows what you're up against. When you face what looks like to be an impossible situation that we're going to talk about tonight, realize that God understands and will help you. The New Testament really starts out the same way as the Old Testament does with Abraham and Sarah. In Luke chapter 1, when the angel told Mary that she was going to have a child, the only question in Mary's mind was, I'm not married yet. Well, they were betrothed, her and Joseph, they were betrothed, but they weren't married yet. They weren't truly a husband and wife yet. So that's why she says, how can this be, since I do not know a man? Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 clearly states that a virgin would conceive and bear a child. Folks, how is that possible? Oh, I know how it's possible. It happened to Abraham and Sarah when they were on the other end of the spectrum. When they couldn't have children, God produced a child for them. And here we are on this end of the spectrum where you have Mary, who is not even with a man yet. And God says, basically, no problem. I did it with Sarah. I can do it with you. And the angel actually tells her that when she says, how can this be since I know not of it? The angel says to her, with God, nothing will be impossible. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I don't know how it happens. I just know rule number one. Write it down. Rule number one, God. That's all you need to know. And when you're up against an impossible situation, or you see rule number one, God. Now, I might let you down. Other folks might let you down. God will never let you down. Why? Because He is God. Nothing shall be impossible with God. Remove the word nothing and put your situation in that highlighted word there. For with God, this problem is too much for Him. He can't help me with this problem. I've been studying with a man that's been a Christian for a while, and he got into a lot of trouble, and he's got a lot of debt. Been there, done that, right? Some of us. He didn't know how he was going to work it out. But after sitting down and talking about the whole thing and sharing with him some of the things I had been through and saying, here's what you need to do. I just talked to him recently, and he is within $4,000 of paying off his debt. And he had $14,000 on one credit card, he had $8,000 on another, he had $7,000 on another, and within a year, he's got it down totally to $4,000. There's a lot more to that story, but I'm just letting you know, he even said, this is impossible for me to work it out. And it isn't. It wasn't. In Luke 18, 27, when Jesus told the apostles about those who are rich will not inherit the kingdom of God. The things which are impossible with men are possible with God. As we think, it's impossible. As God thinks, everything is impossible. So I want to share with you John chapter 6. I tried to pick out what I consider to be a really impossible situation. There's a lot of them. I mean, we could look at Lazarus and we could look at the widow of Nain. But I think this one is more practical for us to look at. And I think I chose this is because this miracle is found in all four Gospels. To me, that makes it significant. So there are some miracles that you only find in Matthew and Mark or Matthew and Luke. This one's in all four. And so I picked John chapter 6 to talk about it. I think it's significant because it looks like this is something that really is in the realm of being impossible. John tells us, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. A great multitude followed him because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, seeing a great multitude coming toward him. He said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. But what are they among so many?" Then Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." There was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain, so that nothing is lost." Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. In going back over the text, I just want to point out a few things to you. First of all, it says, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee. What does that mean, after these things? Because I'm just kind of pulling this out from chapter 5 and it's in the middle. What we find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when you add all four stories up together, you find that Jesus and the apostles have been preaching and teaching so much. It says they didn't even have time to eat. Have you ever had that on your job? Wherever you work? I see a few heads nodding. I've been there. I used to work at a place. I was doing like 80 hours a week. I just didn't have time. I had peanut butter and cheese crackers. That's all you have time for sometimes. That's what happened with Jesus and the apostles. They didn't have enough time to even eat. They were so busy preaching and teaching. So I think when you get to verse 2, when you see this great multitude following him because they saw his signs, you understand that's going to be a great multitude. That's going to be a lot of people. In fact, the text tells us this was over 5,000 men that saw his signs. You know, that's just kind of where you're picking up people as you go along. Who is this? Well, this is Jesus. Oh, I heard something about him. He's performing miracles and healing people. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. I find that kind of interesting that he goes up there perhaps to relax, to get away. But that's really not the kind of place that you should go if you're going to do that, because that's where the action is going to happen. So if you're going up on a mountain and you've got thousands of people following up behind you, there's no way down. So you're going to be stuck up there. And it's kind of like in an old horror movie where, you know, the guy comes in and he's looking to kill. And what happens? You know, the girl runs upstairs. And you want to just yell out, "No, not upstairs. There's no way down. Don't you understand? You're going to have to jump out the window. You know, try to get out in the yard or do something like that." This is kind of the same situation where he's going up on this mountain and there's no way down past these people. But Jesus does it on purpose. There's nothing in the Bible that is by accident. Everything has a purpose and everything has a reason. And it takes a while to learn that, doesn't it? Everything that I read, everything that I see, it's got the hand of God on it. Purpose, plan, providential, every bit of it. There's not a word in this book that doesn't have the imprint of God's breath on it. So this crowd is coming up. And I think the reason John adds that the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near is because you've got thousands and thousands of people that are going to be there for the Passover. If we're to believe Josephus, the historian, he tells us that up to 1 million people would be there on the Passover feast. I don't know if that's reliable, a reliable number, but that's a lot of people. No doubt about that. So I can see where there would be thousands of people. And when Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" No grocery store around, no bread store, no place where you can get food. And the disciples may have thought, oh no, here we are trapped on this mountain and we've got all these thousands of people below us. And it seems to me that's just the way Jesus wanted it. Jesus is setting up this scenario to train these apostles, to teach them that when you face an impossible situation, remember me and remember this situation. I think Jesus puts his apostles in a lot of different situations to let them know you need to believe that I can overcome. That's why he says that later in the Gospel of John. He tells them, I have overcome the world. Be of good courage. So he asked Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? Does that seem a little strange to you? Where shall we buy some bread so we can feed these people? Why pick on Philip? This he said to test him. What's the Lord doing today? Young people, sometimes he might test you. Older people, he may test you too. As age wears on, problems come up, and we may be tested. Because he knew what he was going to do. So why bother asking the question? I think Jesus did that a lot. He makes statements or questions. He tries to get people spurred on to think about the situation. He doesn't want to give them the answer right away. He wants them to think about it. There's not enough thinking going on in our generation, I think. Myself, a lot of people want the answer. They want to go to AI. Watch out, young people. You might go to AI and think your teacher or your professor won't know. My wife's sister up in Ohio teaches, and she can spot AI as quick as that. You know why? I had the answer for you. I've never asked Karen. She can spot it because she's been doing it all her life. She's been grading papers. She's been reading papers. She knows her students. She knows what they're capable of. And as soon as she reads that first sentence, boom, you're on dangerous ground. So watch out. He said it to test him because he knew what he was going to do. Philip! He didn't ask Peter. He didn't ask John. He asked Philip. Why does he pick on Philip? Two things I'll share with you real quick. In John chapter 1, he found Philip and he said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip was the kind of man that when he saw Jesus, he recognized his messiahship. He wanted to follow him. Later in verse 45, Philip went out and found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Now, when you read his response to Nathanael, you can't read that like Yeah, we found him. Moses wrote about him. The prophets talked about him. Jesus of Nazareth. No, no. You got to put a little excitement into it. I see this man on fire. He's like, we found him. The Jews have been waiting all their lives for this moment. The prophets talked about it. Deuteronomy 18. Moses said, there will be a prophet raised up like unto me. In him you shall hear. The prophets talked about this Messiah over and over and over. And finally, he sees Jesus as that Messiah. And he goes to Nathanael and says, we found him. Finally, Moses wrote about him. The prophets wrote about him. It's Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And what does Nathanael do? He's got a bucket of cold water right next to him. And he wakes Philip up. I'm adding that in, you understand. That didn't happen. I'm just trying to throw a little cold water on you that are sleeping. Nathanael said to him, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Philip said, come and see for yourself. He's excited about it. This is the kind of man that you would expect to be excited about it. Nathanael tried to talk him out of it, kind of. He didn't say, well, you know, I hadn't thought about that. Nazareth, yeah, why would the Messiah come out of Nazareth? That doesn't make sense. Yeah, you're right. I'm not going to follow him anymore. No, he says, you need to come see for yourself. That's why Jesus tested him. Now, I want you to see Philip's answer. The question is, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? And he said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. That's not the question, with all respect. That wasn't the question. The question is, where are we going to buy bread so we can feed these people? Philip immediately says, you can't do it. Do you see all these people? There's thousands of people. And by the way, let me just say a word about that. John records for us there's about 5,000 people. But Matthew records, that's beside women and children. So you could easily up the number to at least double, if not tripled, 15,000, maybe 20,000 people. And I know some of you are sitting there saying, yeah, that's not really a lot of people. You know, we're dealing today with millions and billions and trillions, and the numbers just keep going up. Yeah, 5, 10, 15, 20,000, that's not really a lot. When's the last time any of you went over to watch the Bucks play? Okay, maybe nobody. I include myself on that. There's 70,000 people that pack that stadium. And when you're sitting there, that's a lot of people. Even when you're in your living room watching, sensibly watching it, and not paying the price for those kinds of tickets, and getting out like that, you can tell that's a lot of people. It doesn't matter. The point is, whether it's 20,000 people or a million people, Jesus could have fed every single one of them. No doubt about it. Philip says, it can't be done. I guess we always have someone that looks at Philip is only seeing the size of the situation. He's not seeing the size of the Lord. And that's what Jesus wanted to teach him about. When you face an impossible situation, remember this. Rule number one. All he had to do was just say, well, I don't know. You know, maybe the favorite answer in a Bible class. I don't know. Or he could have said, you know, there's a little store we passed about three hills back. Me and the guys can go back there and buy as much bread as we can. Or he could have said, you know, Lord, I've already seen you do some pretty amazing things. I can't do anything about it, but I think you can. That's all the Lord expected out of him. No, he says, even if we had 2/3 of an annual salary, because if you work back in those days, you got a denarii for every work day you work. So that's about, 2/3 of the year. Just say a year's wages. It's not enough that every one of them may have a little crumb. That's what he's saying. Are you like Philip? You whip out your calculator, you know, and you add it all up and you say, see, it's not going to work. The numbers don't lie. We forget one thing. We're not dealing with numbers. We're dealing with God. And that's who makes all the difference in this subject. So while he's having this conversation with the Lord, and by the way, just to make an application, that's what you need to remember. Don't look at the size of your situation and say it can't be done. Say a prayer to God and say, I need your help, and I need your help badly. That's what we need to say. But we have another disciple that's running around at least doing something, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, which is so interesting because some of you may know my brother, Barry. In fact, somebody mentioned him, thought I was Barry. You know, Barry and I don't look alike at all. I don't know if anybody here know Barry. Mary, of course you do, but he preaches over in Claremont. And it's kind of interesting. I'm taller, he's shorter. He has no hair. I have some hair. We don't really look alike. Inevitably, the one person on earth who's no longer with us that used to mix us up all the time was Harry Pickup, Jr. And he knew me very, very well. He and I were very close for a lot of reasons. And he would always call me Barry. And he would call Barry Bruce. One year at a lectureship, Barry and I had this fun idea where we thought, we'll switch our name tags. And so Barry took my name tag, it said Bruce, and I had Barry. And we walked up to Brother Pickup, and he slapped us on the shoulders. He said, you guys get out of here. You know how he would be. Andrew is always going to be Simon Peter's brother, and I'm always going to be either Karen Hudson's brother or Barry Hudson's brother. And that's okay. Barry's a good preacher. He's a great preacher, if you ever have the time to go over to Claremont. And so that's really Andrew. He's kind of in the shadow of his brother, and at least he's been doing something, though. He says, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. That's all he could have done. Just, here's some food. It's like, he's looking for food. He probably overheard what he said to Philip. Where are we going to buy bread that these may eat? And he's like, well, let's see. What do we have here? And I've always felt sorry for the boy. It must have been maybe a boy that's his lunch. And Andrew grabs it from him and brings it to the Lord. And the boy is probably running after him. And it's like, what's going on here? That's my lunch. There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. If he had just stopped right there, it'd been perfect. But he doesn't. Because he's just like you and me. I would have done the same thing. I would have said, well, here's some food. But what are they among so many? He falls right in line with Philip. He falls right in line with the rest of us. That's what everybody would have said. Why? Because we only see the size of the situation and not the size of God. He ruins it by saying, what are they among so many? It's almost like he's excited and then he's depressed about it. He's like showing him the food and then he throws it down on the ground. It's like, but this isn't going to work. Little does he know that is going to work. That's what Jesus is going to use to perform the miracle. Are you like Andrew? We asked if you're like Philip. Now we'll ask you, you know, you figure up everything. And you say, yeah, this isn't going to work out for me. Are you like Andrew? You're hardworking, you're diligent, but you're depressed at the odds against you. Some of you young people maybe are Christians. I went to Manatee High School. It was tough in the early 70s. There's a lot of drugs today. There was a lot of drugs then too. Remember, I was a 60s child. And if you don't know about the 60s, go back and watch some videos. Watch the Woodstock Festival up in New York. Drugs were everywhere. Remember the phrase and expression, free love? That's what they were all about. These were the flower children that are in their 70s now and their 80s. And they're dying off because of some of the things that they talked about. So I do understand what it's like to be tempted to drink a beer or to smoke a cigarette or take a drug. For me, it never appealed to me. Just never did. And I was a rebel, by the way. My mom and dad are gone now, but I rebelled in a lot of ways, so I understand what it's like to be a young person today. Don't worry, you'll grow out of it. You have a little rebellion, and then it's like, you know what? Maybe my mom and dad were right about some things. This, I think, is like a mother who has some children. And she says to the Lord, here are my children, but what are they, or who are they among so many in the world? Billions of children. Or you may be thinking that about giving. You know, here's a few dollars to help out. But what is that among so many dollars in the world? So the disciples are going to carry this out. They're going to act as ushers, so that's why I say the miracle seems to be for them. Jesus tells them to organize this. And when you read the other accounts, it tells us they put them in groups of 50 and groups of 100. You know, I think a lot of people look at the disciples or these apostles, some of them being fishermen. You know, they get a bad rap. They just look at them and say, oh, they're a bunch of fishermen. I've known fishermen, and they're smart. They have their own small business. They know what they're doing. They've got debts. They got to take care of boats. They got to take care of lobster traps and fishing and nets and all of that. There's a lot to it. Peter, Andrew, James, and John were smart men. They ran their own business. So they put these people in groups of 50 and 100. I may not have expected that, but that organizes it, doesn't it? It's, you know, okay, we got a group here, then we'll call them, group A. And here we'll call them group B. And over here we'll have group C. You can almost see this happening on the mountainside there, where group C starts yelling over to one of the apostles and says, hey, Andrew, we're running out of bread over here. We need some more. And group Z over here is saying, we're out of fish. We need some more fish. And so Peter says, hey, I'm bringing it. You just imagine for a minute how that must have been. The miracle is for them. And so Jesus gives thanks for the loaves of the bread and the fish. And I got to tell you, these loaves of bread, when I was a child in Bible class, I used to think these loaves of bread were like, you know, Italian loaves or Cuban loaves of bread. They had to be to feed that many people. But see, a child's mind is thinking that way. And the fish, all I knew was, you know, going to Lake Placid and catching, you know, bass and going to the Sunshine Skyway and catching sunfish and you know, some big fish. And they had to be 5 or 10 pounds each to feed that many people. That's what a child thinks. But they weren't. The fish in this story are like pickled sardines. They're small. And the bread is not like I'm imagining, like Publix bread. No, these are like small, brittle, thin crust, unleavened bread. It has no leaven in it. That maximizes the miracle for us to understand the power that Jesus had here. So, Bob and I were talking about the formatting, so that's what happened there. There's another line down there. It says there, that in verse 12, it says, at the bottom of verse 11, likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So there's three things here I want to suggest to you. First of all, as much as they wanted. Number two says, so when they were filled. Have you ever been to a place where you could have as much as you wanted? Like over in Plant City, Fred's? I asked if you've been to the Raymond J. Have you been to Fred's? I know that you have. I know that you have. They built one over in Riverview. And what I like about Fred's is you eat what you take. So we'll give you a special price, but you don't leave food on your plate. I like that. But as much as you want. You know, I can remember when I was a boy, I used to take my mom to the Sweden House. That was like or Morrison's Cafeteria. Those were the days when I just loved going because I was a young kid. I filled up as much as I wanted. And then it says, so when they were filled. That means what happens like with Vicki and I when we go to a restaurant and my eyes are a little bit bigger than my head and I order something and I have too much and I'm filled. And on the way out, I always make this statement to her, and if she was here, she'd be shaking her head, yes. I say, never again. Never again are we coming here. And a couple years later, there we are, back at Fred's. See, you get a free meal on your birthday. I know about Fred's. They're filled up. These folks have had as much as they wanted. Two, they were filled up. They couldn't eat anymore. I mean, you can almost see some men sitting there on the ground. And Peter's bringing some fish, and he says, you want some more? And they're like, oh no, I've reached my limit. There's a third thing. He says to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. And so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments, which were left over by those who had eaten. There's fragments that remain. These people left food on their plate, so to speak. Much as they wanted, filled to the brim, and there's fragments left over. How much? 12 baskets. Why 12? 12 apostles. So that Peter could go over to his brother Andrew and say, look. And Andrew says, yeah, I've got one too. All this food left over. That's the lesson that I want to share with you tonight. That when you face an impossible situation, leave it to the specialist. Leave it to the one who knows what he's doing, who knows how to do it. Though I don't comprehend it and I don't know how he did it, I believe it because God can do the impossible. What seems impossible to me is no problem for him. So when you face an impossible situation, refuse to doubt it, or worry about it, or calculate it, or work it out. You just need to go to God in prayer and say, take this problem off my hands. Our problem is we hang on to the problem. I learned a lesson when I was a child, a young man. I had a watch, and it was, it broke, and I fixed a couple of things. I thought I was pretty smart at 12, and so I tried to fix the watch. I took the back cover off, and all these parts fell out. It's not like watches today. In the old days, because I'm getting older, these parts fell out. Well, over by Westgate Publix, off of Manatee Avenue, over by the Shake Pit where we had our 1950s burgers, there was an old guy there that ran a watch and clock shop. And when you went in, he had stools, and you would sit on the stool. And when he came in, he was a short guy. He's an old man, short guy. He had the glasses on. He had the magnifiers on his eyes. And he got up and got on his stool. And so I had laid my watch and its parts all over the counter. And we didn't say anything. He just went, you tried to fix it yourself, didn't you? He knew. I said, yes, sir. He said, and I never forgot it, so I could use it in a lesson like this. He said, whenever you have a problem like this, bring it to a specialist like me. Because see where you are now? It's not working out. He said, I know how to fix it. And I thought, you know, that's kind of like the Lord. He knows how to fix it. But we try to fix it ourselves. And when we try to fix it ourselves, we make it worse. And we turn it into 19 complex knots. And then we're in a bit of frustration. We say, you know what? Oh, yeah, God. Here, God, you take care of it and give it back to me in 5 minutes, all fixed. Now you're asking for a miracle in 5 minutes. A problem that you've been multiplying for maybe months or years, and it's been getting worse and worse and worse. Leave it to the specialist. We have doctors who are specialists. Maybe we have a doctor here tonight. Most doctors now are specialists. So if you've got a problem with your foot, you go see a podiatrist. You've got a problem with your brain, you go see a brain surgeon. You've got a problem with your heart, you go see a cardiologist. Why? They do that every day. It's like a mechanic. He does that every day. Why would I try? I mean, the old days, yeah, I could fix my car. I could put a fan belt on. I could change my oil. I could put on my brakes. I could do all that. Today, it's all computerized. It's like going up to a car specialist and saying, can you put a fan belt on? He's going to chuckle and say, can I put a fan belt on? Or going up to Beethoven and saying, can you play chopsticks? Can I play chopsticks? When we lived up in Maine, we lived up in the northern part for a little while, up in Caribou. Loring Air Force Base was up there. And Phil Lumpkin was a pilot of a B-52. So I got to go on a B-52. And I did the dumbest thing ever when I got on there. Phil was in his, you know, nice uniform. He had his shades on, his hat. And I'm just looking inside this cockpit at all the stuff. And I dumbly said to Phil, Phil, can you really fly this? And he went with his glasses. He said, can I fly it? I can fly it blindfolded. And I believed him. I think he could. This happens to Jesus. First, I want to remind us of Philippians 4:13, where Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Are there a few things you can't do, maybe, Paul? No, he says, all. I can do all things through the Lord. Why? Because he strengthens me. I want to take you to Mark chapter 9 real quick for a minute. But I think Jesus probably felt this way in this situation when this father brought his son to Jesus. And Jesus asked him, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And often he's thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And one day I was reading that years ago, and it just dawned on me. What went through the mind of Jesus at that moment? It's the same moment I had with Phil. Can you really do this? The Father says, if you can do anything, you would expect Jesus to respond, if I can do anything, do you know who you're talking to? Jesus said to him, notice what he tells him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. The problem is that with God, it's not with Jesus. It's not with the Lord. Oh, the problem is with us. That we don't believe that he can fix our situation. I want to finish by saying this in Mark chapter 8. After this kind of lesson, we all go out of here and, yep, we need to remember this. When I face an impossible situation, go to the Lord in prayer. We have a song we sing, take it to the Lord in prayer. So you sing that all the time. Practice it. Do it. Take it to the Lord in prayer. In Mark chapter 8, it's interesting. Another scenario comes up. Now, I'm going to close on this verse. It says, now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. So Matthew records that Jesus was talking to them about the doctrine of the Pharisees and not bread. And they were worried that Jesus was scolding them because they had no bread. No, Jesus is scolding them for not remembering that he could do anything. Then he charged them, saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they said, well, it's because we have no bread. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? 2,000 years later in 2025, that's what I'm asking you. After the lesson for tonight, do you not remember what we talked about? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said to him, 12. And when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said 7. Because he did it again. He didn't just do it once. He did it again to feed people. And then he says this to them, that had I been there, I just think maybe I might have broke out crying. Because he says to them, how is it that you don't understand? How many times am I going to have to tell you guys I really can do anything? And that's the lesson for you. When you face what looks like to be an impossible situation, know that you're not alone. The whole human race has been through this. And some of them depended upon God, trusted in God, and prayed to God to help them with that situation. And that's what you need to do. If you're not a Christian, why not tonight? And you know what you need to do to be saved. Won't you come while together we stand up and sing?